It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the Trump campaign, the Benghazi report, and the general election forecast in our political roundup that's coming up in about 10 minutes.
First, a new report takes a critical look at the manufacturing and agriculture credit, which was passed by the legislature in 2011. The report says the tax credit reduces state income by $284 million a year and has done little to promote job creation.
Polo Rocha joins us now to talk about the new report and what kind of reaction it's gotten so far. He's a reporter and editor at wisbusiness.com. Polo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a look at the manufacturing and agriculture credit. What is it? How does this work?
Right. So this is a tax credit that was passed as part of the 2011 budget to boost the manufacturing and agriculture sectors. Basically, it's a tax credit of 7.5% on any manufacturing and agriculture activity. So any income that companies get from those activities, their income tax liability is reduced. And so essentially, businesses and individuals can apply for this. And the by individuals, I mean like those owners of companies whose business income is part of their individual tax credits. And it's a 7.5% tax credit on that activity. So for some people, it might actually wipe out a good chunk of their tax liability.
And the idea behind this credit was, I suppose, if they're paying lower taxes getting this credit, they'd have more capital to create jobs, to develop their businesses. Was that the goal there?
Yeah, so, you know, if you talk to, like, the state chamber of commerce and the local chamber of commerce folks, they often bring up that, you know, the state needs to be competitive in its tax climate for businesses. And so this is kind of one of their pitches when they talk to companies about either coming here or staying here or expanding here. So, yeah, that was the aim.
And was this a tax credit that was being scaled in over the years? It looks like the amount that's gone into it has gone up over the years.
Yep. It started to be phased in, I think, in fiscal year 2013. So it cost $15 million at the time, and it's gradually gone up. It's now going to be at its permanent top level of 7.5%. And it's going to cost, the next fiscal year, it's going to cost $284 million. And that's about double, actually more than double than the state had originally projected. It originally said it might cost $129 million a year.
And let's get to this new report. Who released this today?
So this is a report released actually yesterday by the Wisconsin Budget Project, which is a liberal-leaning group in Madison. And so that kind of has started off the discussion, and it found that there's been little evidence that the tax credit has actually boosted manufacturing jobs. Also called it a boon for the wealthy. It said that 78% of the tax credits will go towards those individuals making $1 million or more. So that's kind of sparked the whole debate. And then today there was a reaction from the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business association, and they basically said that this report is fatally flawed.
Yeah, what was their argument for the flaw in the report? And I guess this is a back and forth of the issue of whether this credit is creating jobs.
Right, definitely. And so one of the things that is kind of hard to parse out is whether or not this is actually creating jobs. These credits are not actually tied to job creation measures, so it's going to be really hard even in the future to figure out whether this credit actually led to jobs being created. But, you know, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce is saying the manufacturing sector has created 34,000 jobs since 2011. You know, that's not necessarily because of the tax credit, but, you know, they point toward that as saying that, you know, this is helping businesses expand. They pointed to the pear manufacturer called Bellmark that said it's opening another facility in Chowano specifically because of this tax credit. So that's the argument that they're making.
Talking to Polo Rocha, he's a reporter and editor at wisbusiness.com, looking at a new report on these tax credits here in Wisconsin aimed at boosting manufacturing and agricultural businesses. That's the hope. The report from a liberal group generally critical of this kind of thing says it's failing. It's not creating new jobs. A tricky thing in measuring this, Polo, is some people have said before 2011 we saw job declines. After 2011 and this new tax credit, we've seen increases in manufacturing. But that was before and after the Great Recession, too. So are people trying to factor that in as they weigh the impact of this credit?
Yeah, I mean, that certainly plays a major factor. I think it's all part of the broader argument among Democrats and Republicans about whether a state has or hasn't created jobs. So both sides are presenting a pretty different picture here, and it's kind of unclear, and it will be unclear, whether these tax credits actually led to jobs being created. But I think at the end of the day, $284 million is a good chunk of money, but it's a pretty small amount compared to the overall Wisconsin economy. So some folks are thinking that this might actually not have that big of an impact.
One critique from the Wisconsin Budget Project was that because these credits aren't linked to job creation, in some cases it's gone to companies that have laid people off, outsourced jobs to other states, or closed plants. Is that a big part of their critique here?
Yeah, that's certainly a big critique, and you know, especially other Democrats like Gordon Hintz are saying that, you know, he put out a report today saying that 11 people who make $35 million or more are going to get $21 million in tax credits, and you know, these tax credits are not necessarily tied to, unlike credits with the WEDIC jobs agency, they're not tied to, you know, whether you create jobs. There's no sorts of like clawback provisions or anything about, you know, if you don't create jobs or if you outsource jobs somewhere else, you're not going to get this tax credit. So that's certainly been a big point that Democrats have hit on.
You mentioned some of the Democratic response to this report. Have we heard anything from Republicans or from the governor's office on it?
The governor's office kind of took a similar tone that the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Group did. You know, they basically said the economy is improving. We're having more and more manufacturing jobs, but not too much response aside from those two.
Is there any sense that this report and the critique that came along with it is going to influence the future of the manufacturing and agriculture tax credit?
So that's a bit unclear. I think we're starting next year, we're going to see the full impact, and it's going to be fully phased in. It's a bit unclear whether anything's actually going to happen. And I should note that Democrats and other folks have raised concerns about this tax credit before, and certainly nothing has happened since the 2011 budget to significantly reduce that or eliminate that. So, I mean, the debate will continue, and this is just another data point that they'll have to say that, you know, this is geared toward the wealthy and it's not very effective. But I don't know that this is actually going to do much at the end of the day.
One big picture question before I let you go, Polo. This is a tax credit aimed at agriculture and manufacturing, obviously two key sectors in Wisconsin. Even if this particular method isn't agreed on, is there general agreement that these are key parts of the economy? Everybody in government is looking for some way to boost them?
There definitely are, but that said, I mean, some folks in the startup community might say, you know, this $284 million that we'll be losing out in the next fiscal year, and that money could go to helping new sectors of the economy, some of these technology startups all across the state, and it could also, you know, go toward education and whatnot, which could help the state economy in the future. So, I mean, I think there's obviously wide agreement that these are two big sectors, but there's competing sectors that could also get more money because of this tax credit.
Polo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yep, thank you. Have a good one.
That's Polo Rocha, reporter and editor for WizBusiness.com. He joins us to talk about a new report that says a tax credit for manufacturing and agriculture businesses has done little to boost jobs in the state.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about the arrest of 18-year-old Janelle Laird, an African-American woman who was tased and struck during her arrest by two white police officers in Madison.
First, we have our weekly recap of the latest in national politics.
There's a major shakeup in the Trump campaign with the firing of campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, but he didn't stay out of the public eye for too long, becoming now a political pundit.
The Benghazi report was released this week after a two-year-long investigation into the State Department and Hillary Clinton's role as Secretary of State. We'll talk about the results and how they might affect her campaign.
And November, creeping closer every day, 538.com has released a general election forecast.
Harry Enten's back with us now. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So the result of the two-year Benghazi investigation is out, looking into potential wrongdoing on the part of the State Department and the Obama administration, also on the part of possible presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. So what came out of that report?
Nothing really new. Look, basically, you had the House Republicans who capped their two-year investigation, and they faulted the Obama administration for some security lapses. But it wasn't like anything that came out that showed that they were malicious or that they did anything that was like so strikingly wrong as if to really fault them in any other way of saying, look, this is a bureaucracy. Certain things should have happened, been handled differently. But there was a perfect storm that kind of just came together, and unfortunately it resulted in the deaths of four Americans. But it's not as if anything in this report is something that we really didn't know before. And it's not something, in my opinion, if you look at it, that is really going to hurt Hillary Clinton's chances to win the presidency beyond of which this already has.
Now, at a news conference this week, the head of the House Select Committee on Benghazi had this to say.
Washington had access to real-time information, but yet somehow they thought the fighting had subsided. Washington had access to real-time information, but somehow they thought these fighters were going to evacuate, even without the remains of the ambassador, and without asking how is that evacuation supposed to be effectuated. How were you supposed to get from the annex to the Benghazi airport? Because it took you almost 3 hours to get from the airport to the annex. Who is supposed to take you?
So the head of the House Select Committee finding some culpability there. And the question remains, you're getting at that, Harry, is will this be a factor in the presidential race for Hillary Clinton?
I think that if you thought that Hillary Clinton acted in a way that was made her unfit to be commander-in-chief before this, you still feel that way. If you thought she acted in a way that, although perhaps not perfect, did not disqualify her from being president, then I think you probably still think that way. You know, the Democrats put out their own report in which, you know, they basically said they were locked out of the Republican majority report. There is, in my opinion, just not very much here that would make anyone really change their mind about how they already feel about Hillary Clinton. That doesn't mean that she acted perfectly, and I think most people would agree that she didn't, but it just, based upon what we already knew, this report doesn't add very much.
So is this, at the end of the day, going to be sort of a partisan lens that this is viewed through? If you're a Republican, you think there are things here that are serious, and if you're a Democrat, you think maybe it's not such a severe thing.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it's basically, however you see Hillary Clinton and Democratic Party and Barack Obama, you probably see this report. So if you like her, then you're probably willing to give them the benefit of the doubt with understanding that perhaps things could have been handled better. And if you're a Republican who's predisposed to hate Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, this report gives you plenty of fuel to continue to do so.
We're talking national politics right now with Harry Enten from 538. And Harry, let's talk about the state of the Trump campaign. Now, I think last week we were talking about the firing of Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski. And that wasn't the end of him, though. He has resurfaced now as a pundit on CNN. So is this a surprise that the turnaround would be this quick for him?
I mean, CNN has made a wonderful home for many pro-Trump analysts. If you wish to call them analysts. This isn't too surprising to me. I mean, oftentimes you find people who are let go of campaigns. You saw the same thing with some of Ted Cruz's folks during the campaign where they were let go and then they were signed on as analysts. So this isn't too surprising to me. I think there's a question that's beyond my pay grade about, you know, the role of former advisors appearing on television as analysts and thereby perhaps providing analysis that maybe is a little more friendly to particular candidates than you might otherwise expect. But this isn't surprising at all, not to me anyway.
There has been some lingering questions here about CNN's decision to do this insofar as Lewandowski has been on the front lines of tensions with the media, with CNN and other organizations. So is there any gray area there about maybe the ethical questions?
Oh, I think there's tremendous gray area. I'm not in a position to answer that, but I think there's tremendous gray area. You know, someone pointed out to me, well, you know, Paul Begala, who's a longtime Clinton friend and has had some involvement in one of the super PACs backing Hillary Clinton, he regularly appears on television. But, of course, there's a difference between being, you know, a member of a super PAC and being a Democrat or being a Republican, being a fan of a politician, and then literally getting right off that campaign and then going to TV and you know, doing supposedly straightforward analysis. And I'd also point out that in the past, you know, Trump has kind of let people go, like Roger Stone, who's a longtime Republican strategist, and then it was kind of unclear whether he was actually part of the campaign or whether he was still giving advice to the campaign, and the Trump campaign kind of blurs those lines, and Lewandowski especially, who, as you mentioned, has not exactly been friendly with the press and has kind of cut press access off. I do wonder, but that's not for me to answer. CNN has him on the air, and I believe they'll continue to have him on the air.
In terms of, you know, the insider scoop on the Trump campaign, there are questions there. Apparently, he has in his contract he's not allowed to reveal anything that would be detrimental to the Trump campaign, give away any sort of secrets of the campaign. So how much utility do you think he can have as an analyst on CNN?
I'm not sure he can have much utility as an analyst, as much as he could potentially, you know, give you an idea into sort of the Trump fan mindset. I think, you know, it's, if you look at who's generally on television and kind of the demographics of the people who are generally on television who are providing analysis, they don't generally tend to line up with people who like Donald Trump. So I think there's nothing wrong with perhaps providing, you know, more friendly Trump voices as long as it's recognized that that's exactly what they are. But I do think that there is some question as to whether it's really legitimate to have someone who's literally fresh off of the campaign, and it's unclear exactly what ties he still perhaps has to Donald Trump, and then have him providing analysis such as, this was one of the best speeches I ever heard Trump give. It's very clear that he's still very sympathetic to Trump's cause, and I'd say there's some ethical line there. I don't know where it is, but that certainly is going to get spoken about and has been spoken about.
Well, it's still some months until the general election, but 538 has just released its forecast for the general election. What are the big headlines there?
I think the biggest headline is, you know, basically that if the election were held today, we'd expect Hillary Clinton to probably win. We have her well into the mid-80s as a chance of winning. That doesn't mean Donald Trump can't win, but if the election were held today, we'd expect that Hillary Clinton would probably win. And our forecast, too, we have two forecasts, one that's based pretty much solely off of the polls, mostly the state polls. That gives Hillary Clinton about an 80% chance of winning. Again, Donald Trump could still win, with a, you know, he has about a 20% chance. And if we take into account the fundamentals, basically being the state of the economy, we still have Hillary Clinton as a pretty sizable favorite around. She'll win about three-fourths of the time. But again, Trump can win. It's just that he probably won't win, but he can win.
So what do you expect? What sorts of things could come to upset the calculus that you've used so far?
Well, you know, I think, you know, part of the reason that we still give Donald Trump a chance is because there's still a lot of the campaign to be left. Let's see what happens at the conventions. Historically speaking, conventions have turned around campaigns that looked like they weren't going anywhere. So, for instance, in 1988, George Herbert Walker Bush was trailing in the polls to Michael Dukakis through much of the early summer. He got a convention bounce. He held that convention bounce, and Bush won that election. 4 years later, Bill Clinton really was not doing particularly well in the polls against George H.W. Bush. He went in the convention. Everyone agreed he had a good convention, and he held the lead after the convention, then held that through that all the way through November. So I think the conventions are a big one. There could be smaller things that can add up, but I think let's see where the polls are in late August. If Hillary Clinton still holds a sizable lead in the polls then, we'll see the odds go up considerably.
I mean, you use the word sizable. It's 80-20. That seems like an awfully big spread. Is that unusual?
It's larger than the spread that was 4 years ago. But I should say, you know, 20% things happen all the time. You know, if I'm trying to catch the one train in New York City and it comes every 5 minutes, then, you know, there's about a 20% chance that I will get it within a minute, you know, within a minute. And that happens quite frequently. More times than not, though, I miss the train. Or I have to wait more than a minute, but sometimes I do get it. So 20%, while small, is certainly sizable enough that Donald Trump can win this election. It's just more likely that Hillary Clinton will.
So looking at it state by state, with a focus right now on swing states, what did you see there, including Wisconsin?
Well, if you look at all the swing states, Hillary Clinton basically holds where you'd expect her to lead. She's leading, including in the state of Wisconsin. She holds a sizable lead, which isn't too surprising, given that, you know, if you look at the polls that have come out from the state of Wisconsin, she has led in every single one of them going back, as far as I can possibly remember and as far as the model has. So, for instance, if you were to look, that's not surprising that our polls-only forecast has her winning 86% of the time in the state of Wisconsin. That makes sense. If you go to a state like Florida, we have her winning in the polls-only forecast by greater than 70% of the time. Again, the model is basically looking at the polls and giving you an idea of how often do these leads that that Hillary Clinton has right now in these individual states, how often do they hold? And more times than not, the leads that Hillary Clinton has right now are sizable enough that we expect them to hold, but it's not a guarantee.
And where are you seeing leads for Donald Trump? Where could he build?
I think the path for Trump, obviously he wants to build upon the Romney map. He has to hold on to a state like Arizona where the polls right now aren't too friendly to him. And then probably he'll want to go and take a state like Ohio, North Carolina, which Romney won last time, then perhaps Pennsylvania, although our model is more favorable to Clinton in Pennsylvania than a number of the polls out currently. There are some polls that give some strength to Trump. So I think Trump really wants to build in the Rust Belt states and then hold on to the Romney states and then perhaps hope for a lucky break or two, and that's probably his best bet.
So, Harry, as you know, last week, a huge surprise with the vote to leave the EU, the Brexit happened, and that vote surprised a lot of people. If you're reading the tea leaves there, do you see anything that result could portend for the election here in November?
Not really. I would say never be too sure of anything. Don't take conventional wisdom and run with it in terms of the election here. But the other thing that's also true is if you look at all the polls, Remain only led in 51% of them from when the pollster.com database started. I think the big lesson there is to trust the polls. And if you trust the polls in this particular case, understanding that there can be some movement, then the polls say Hillary Clinton at this point.
Harry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He joins us on Wednesdays to give us the latest in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we talk about police use of force after a viral video showed an African-American woman being tased and struck when arrested by two white police officers in Madison. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talked to a Middle East expert about yesterday's terror attack in Turkey.
First, a video of the arrest of Janelle Laird, a young black woman, went viral last week. In the video, she was confronted outside of Madison's Easttown Mall by two white male police officers who used force, including a taser and physical force, to restrain her.
Laird was being arrested after mall security called the police after she allegedly confronted a food court employee with a knife, claiming that her cell phone had been stolen. After being taken into custody, she was ultimately released 2 days later and referred to an alternative restorative justice program.
Madison Police Chief Mike Koval will join us tomorrow, but in an earlier press conference, he said that the police department goes on over 15,000 calls a month and that in their most recent quarterly report on use of force, only 0.0025 of 1% fell into that category. He said engagements were overwhelmingly characterized as peaceful.
There are still many questioning police use of force and police accountability in Laird's case. Joining us now is Eric Upchurch. He's one of the co-founding members of the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition, and he wrote a piece for Madison 365 called Why Janelle's Release is Not Really a Win for Her or Any of Us. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So Janelle Laird was released, put in this alternative program instead of being charged potentially with felonies. You say it's not a win for her or for the community. Why not?
Well, as I outlined in the article, anytime that you're the reason we have to take a look at this from the standpoint of why this is an exception, why Janelle is getting this exception. District Attorney Ozan made it clear that the Dane County's restorative justice court program or restorative court program is for youth offenders with misdemeanor level crimes. But here we have felony level crimes that are being treated as misdemeanor crimes. And so what's the reason for that exception? And when you look at the case, and District Attorney Ozan says that the community's overwhelming response to this case gives rise to the exception. And well, why did the community respond this way? If you look on Facebook, if you look at all of the comments, you'll see overwhelmingly people are saying this should not have happened. It doesn't matter what Janelle was doing before this moment. What we saw was a subdued 103-pound 18-year-old unarmed black girl standing alone with an officer, and moments later she had racked up felony charges and officers were, quote, injured as a result of their attempt to control a situation that was already under control. So because we see an exception, we treat the case exceptionally, it's almost counterintuitive to then refer to allow this exception to culminate in a restorative justice practice, which really is a distraction in a way, because it doesn't take away the felonies that the community overwhelmingly has exclaimed she does not deserve, and which has given rise to this exception. So we have an exception, but it's not a real exception.
What do you think we should be focusing on this incident instead of this, as you suggest, exception to the rule that you're pointing out?
Well, I think we should be focusing on why the situation went the way that it did, and why it's being handled in a way that's contrary to what anyone who's seen this video would believe it should be handled. And there are two reasons for that, and they all fall under the same umbrella of the need for community control over police. If the community was in control of the police, actually a good example, Tessa Lee Kellogg, she crashed a moped on the same day, crashed her moped. She resisted arrest. She wasn't brutalized. She wasn't beaten. And part of the reason for that is because the police are accountable to the white community. This was a white woman. There was something in that police officer that let him know that he should not kick and beat and punch and tase this white woman. But here we have a young black girl in a similar situation, calm, in fact, and she did not resist. What she did do was react to the escalation that trained police officers induced. So we need to foster a culture that doesn't make that seem like a good idea to police officers. And what we've seen is that when police officers are accountable to the communities that they serve, things like this happen less. So that's the why it happened. That's part of addressing why it happened. Now, how we're responding to it, we're responding to this with restorative justice. We're responding to this with felony charges. And by we, I mean the city. I mean Madison Police Department. This is not something that anyone, I would say, who, it's just not right. And the community should be able to say, this isn't right, and we should be able to treat this case in a truly restorative fashion where we're holding the City of Madison Police Department accountable for their actions. Madison Police Department isn't being held accountable here. We have officers being called victims of and being battered by a 103-pound 18-year-old black girl. How are trained officers being battered by, I mean, where in that video did we see officers being battered? And if you look at the charges, they're all related to the escalation that the officers induced, but we have no accountability for the officers, and that is where we sell ourselves short. If we're going to see differences, if we're going to see benefits, if we're going to see real change, we have to hold the officers accountable as well.
Some people, in watching the video and looking at the police report, have said she had been reported as issuing threats of violence. had displayed a weapon. She wasn't complying with police orders at that point, and people said police are using their training to try to get compliance in with someone who had made a threat, who had displayed a weapon. You don't buy that ultimately?
No, I don't buy that. I mean, first off, let's just say it was a gun and not a knife. Okay, we've seen many times, and I'll use Dylann Roof as an example. This guy walked into a church and shot 9 people and walked out, and you know, was damn near holding hands with police officers. Where was the? Was it because he was more compliant? Did he didn't resist, or did they just not escalate the situation? We have Janelle here. There's this alleged knife in the mix, but in the video that we all saw, there was no knife. In the video that we all saw, there was no threat. So people saying she deserved this, I mean, if you were standing still and someone walked up to you and began to escalate and threaten you, what would you do? So there's a break in that analysis. And I could understand if maybe she was wielding some weapon and they arrived on the scene and they said, drop your weapon, and she didn't. I could understand a need, the feeling of a need to control the situation. But that's not what we were witnessing. We were witnessing a girl who was unarmed, without a weapon, standing still, and the Madison Police Department escalated the situation in a way that caused her injury.
Talking to Eric Upchurch from the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition, talking about this incident that went viral. It was caught on video of an arrest of a young black woman in a Madison mall. The Madison Police Department Professional Standards Division will be reviewing this incident. The police chief looking for an independent investigator to look at the footage. What would you like to see when it comes to how police interact with the public, with black people in particular in Madison in situations like this? What would you like to see change, Eric?
Well, we need real accountability, and we have to accept the fact that everyone's human. We all have our flaws. We all have our shortcomings. I don't know what it's like to live the life of someone that's differently abled, has a wheelchair, so I'm naturally just going to do and say things that in some cases might neglect that population. But I have to make an effort. I have to recognize that. I have to make continuous effort to be mindful of that. We don't see that here in our police department. And because of that, and because of the detrimental effects that they have on our community, we need community control over the police. If we live in a democracy, if the people have the power, then what's the issue with community control over the police? That's going to ensure that less of these things happen and that we get officers like those that escalate situations for no reason, like Matt Kenny, who killed Tony Robinson and also killed in 2007. We'll get them out of the way so that we can be truly safe on both sides of the fence.
We'll bring in a caller now. Mike is with us from Ladysmith. Mike, hi.
Yeah, I'm reacting to this the premise that he's setting up about how police should be taking account. When, first of all, videos stand on their own by themselves, but they lose all context. So if you get a call, and I'll just include the officer that was involved in the shooting last year, I'll include that in the same analysis. Is that if you get a call to respond to a situation in which there is already violence occurring, which there has been a threat of violence or a threat of a weapon, and that is what the officer is responding to, so already in his head, he, whether he sees a weapon or not, he knows that what he's been called to is a situation that has already been violent, has already been reported to either have a weapon or there's been other physical violence occurring. And then when they get on the scene, if the person does not, respond to the orders of the officer to be calm and to, put their hands behind their back or whatever the order may be, that is resisting arrest, and they have every right to be defending themselves against what they don't know is being a clear situation.
Mike, thanks for the call. So the video doesn't give us all the context, Mike says, Eric, and there's a potentially dangerous situation. Officers, he says, justified in escalating the use of force.
Well, I would say that the reaction of the district attorney and the chief of police would say otherwise. And let's just focus on them for a second. Let's assume that they have all of the pieces of information needed to make a sound judgment about the situation. And their judgment is, wait a minute, this case needs to be treated differently. If the officers were justified in their conduct, why are we having this discussion? Why is our felony charges being referred to a restorative justice pilot program that's only meant for misdemeanors? If nothing went wrong here, if there was no need for exception. So I'm going to defer to the public officials and the law enforcement here, where they say, look, this wasn't right, and we're going to do something about that. But what they did just wasn't enough, and it didn't hold the officers accountable. It didn't hold true to the reason why they said this wasn't right.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Eric Upchurch. He's a founding member of the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition. He wrote a Madison 365 piece called Why Janelle's Release is Not Really a Win for Her or Any of Us.
We'll pick up our conversation and talk to the former chief of the Madison Police Department in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the recent arrest and subsequent release of 18-year-old Janelle Laird. A video of her arrest at Madison's Easttown Mall went viral last week and reignited the conversation about the use of force by police, especially on African Americans.
The current Madison Police Chief Mike Koval has stood by the officers who arrested Laird, but mentioned there will be an investigation. Here he is talking about the arrest at a press conference.
In the course of making her arrest finally happen, as you see, it went from bad to worse in terms of her unwillingness to simply surrender her liberty, put her hands behind her back, allow her wrist to be handcuffed and put in the back seat of a squad car. I think that the decentralization, which went to the floor, and subsequently those strenuous back and forth between the officers as well as her, those will be the issues that will ultimately be evaluated by administrative review and ultimately determine whether the officers in fact use the appropriate use of force consistent with state guidelines.
Koval went on to say that the video is a snapshot of what happened from the point of onset, the point that the officers were finally able to put her in handcuffs. We'll be talking to Chief Koval tomorrow. Now we're going to get a perspective from the former chief of the Madison Police Department. Reverend David Cooper served as Madison Police Chief from 1972 to 93. He's the author of the book Arrested Development, A Veteran Police Chief Sounds Off About Protest, Racism, Corruption, and the Seven Necessary Steps to Improve Our Nation's Police. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me here.
Well, you've written about this, and I want to key in on something that Chief Koval had said. Did the officers act consistently with state guidelines? You've written that in many cases, you think, is not enough. State guidelines aren't enough. Police departments should do better. Why is that?
Well, those are the minimum standard, just like the deadly force standard that was articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court in their 1989 decision on Graham versus Connor, is saying that sort of a standard of if an officer feels fear that he or she can use deadly force to eliminate that threat. That's the lowest standard. That's whether or not we put police officers in jail for violating it. What I'm talking about is how does the community want its police officers to operate. And that goes the same for those state defensive tactic standards is, sir, sure. And that's why the Janelle thing will probably turn out to be, oh, officers were following their training. And I'm saying, stop, community, look at this training. Do you want, as Chief Koval mentioned, officers in handling a young woman to use what is called these decentralization tactics and use knee strikes to her torso and to get her on the ground and repeatedly tase her? Is this what we want to accept in the community? And so I would tend to join what Eric Upchurch says. Is, to me, community-oriented policing is the community sets the standards for their police, saying that is not appropriate, this is what we want instead, and the police must comply. Now, that creates a lot of attention in the community, but precisely that's what it's all about. Then all we have to do is add the ingredient of race. And what we're trying to do in this country right now is to rebuild trust among communities of color that police can be trusted and supported in their work. And post-Ferguson, that has tended to be pretty well, that bank account of police trust has been pretty well emptied. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And this is not new. I mean, I dealt with this in 1968 in the middle of the civil rights movement when I was a street cop in Minneapolis. Dr. King had been shot. I realized right then, and a few of my colleagues realized at the same time, that from this time on, every encounter with a black person is going to, we're going to have to demonstrate that we're not like those cops in the South.
Well, looking at the idea of community standards here, there's been a really split response to people seeing this video, looking at the police report, some saying, as you do, as our previous guest said, that this was an over-escalation by police. Other people, like one of our previous callers and others out there saying, you've got somebody who threatened violence, you've got somebody who brandished a knife. Police are justified, if they don't comply, in escalating the use of force to guarantee compliance and really guarantee that there's not a lethal outcome in this. So what do you say to them?
First of all, Janelle did not have a knife in her hand. I understand the knife was in the backpack, and it was something that she did earlier. But I come from the school that says it doesn't make any difference what your prior conduct was. You know, we're not going to use that when we arrest you. We're not going to punish you for what you did. What we're going to do is put you into custody so that the system can respond to what we say that you've done. And I'm just saying that, you know, I've led police for 25 years. I've been a police chief. I worked on a street and a tactical unit for 8 to 10 years before that. I taught self-defense tactics throughout the state of Minnesota for about 5 years before I came to Madison. And I'm telling you that that is an unacceptable takedown and use of force by two police officers that should know better and know how to handle a young 100-plus pound woman, regardless of her level of restraints. That she did not have to be treated that way. And I don't care which way this goes, if officers are found to have been legally operated, and they very may well are saying this keeps with the legal standard, this is how they're trained, I'm saying the community stop right there and say, is this the way, you know, you want your daughters handled? And I would say that anybody who watches those videos say, I don't want my daughter treated like that. Now, some people might say they do. But in a free society, in a democratic society, in which people's rights are very, very important, and how we respect human persons is ultimately the test of this society, police can do better.
What would you like to see different in police training? How would you like to see police trained going into an incident like this?
Well, first of all, sure, you know, police are trained, and we know how to take somebody to the ground when they have to. But this did not necessitate, this level of resistance by a young girl did not necessitate the kind of techniques that you do to take down a 200-pound intoxicated man. So there's a level of proportionality here, and proportionality has to be into this equation. There's no reason why two police officers, each grabbing her wrist, having control of her shoulder, could not escort her to that police car and take her out of custody. Even if we ratchet back, if she was in an extremely, you know, high, agitated attitude at that time, they could have waited there. They could have put her in an office and talked to her and calmed her down before they attempted to take her out. They could have called for a female officer, preferably, I think, then we certainly have a diverse police department, a female officer of color who would come in there and talk to Janelle and try to get this thing settled down. There's a lot of things that could have been done that weren't done, and this did not turn out very well.
David, briefly, as we wrap up, what would you like to see the next step be from city leadership, the community, the police department?
Well, we must have a community-wide discussion about this, and instead of running, you know, everybody, you know, taking to the barricades, the police chief has to understand the feelings of the black community when they see two white officers use what I would term excessive force on a young black woman. That has high tension placed into this community. So the police department has to get down there and talk with the community and say, look, this was not right. We can do better, and we will show you how we're doing better. So there's got to be some demonstrated change that's going on there. If 40% of all the arrests of people in Madison are people of color, then how people treat people of color is very important to everyone.
And we'll leave it there for now, David. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. You're welcome.
That's Reverend David Cooper. He served as Madison Police Department Chief from 1972 to 1993. We talked about this police use of force incident went viral after the arrest and subsequent release of 18-year-old Janelle Laird. A couple years back, our friends at Wisconsin Public Television gave us a unique view of Wisconsin in Wisconsin from the Air, featuring video of the state taken from a plane.
And now a Wisconsin-born astronaut is taking things to a whole new level. Jeff Williams from the Village of Winter in Sawyer County has been sharing photos of the state taken from the International Space Station. We've linked to a slideshow on the Wisconsin State Journal, and there are great images there of Duluth Superior, the North Woods, the Lake Michigan shoreline, and, of course, the Village of Winter.
Plus shots of the big cities in the state, Milwaukee, Madison, and Green Bay. You took a look. Any struck you is particularly awesome. They're all pretty cool.
I think it's just really cool to see a spotlight from outer space, in a sense, shine on Wisconsin. We don't often see these things. We see the Great Wall of China and the oceans, but here we see Wisconsin as seen from outer space.
And it's funny what got me. A lot of times they're in map perspective, like north is up, south is down. There was one of the whole state, like, mostly upside down, and it took me, it was surprising how long it took me to puzzle out, like, wait, is that, oh, wait, no, I see the UP up there. Okay, now I've got my bearings on it. So, yeah, a whole new, different, cool
right.
view.
It still looks beautiful, even from outer space.
All right, some Wisconsin love from way up in the sky. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.